I got an email this week. I couldn't figure out an email from someone who lives out of town, listens to the Nexus podcast, and this woman said, "Hey, I've been really following along the past few weeks, enjoying what you're saying, but I can't figure out something. You keep talking about Jesus in the skies. What do you mean when you talk about Jesus in the skies?" And I sat there going, "What in the world? I don't remember talking about Jesus in the skies." And then it hit me, Jesus in disguise. And she had heard Jesus in the sky. So I'm trying to work on my punctuation a little, make sure we understand we're talking about Jesus in disguise, not the sky. Oh my. Anyway, yeah. I was asked a few weeks ago to speak to a class at Rockway Mennonite. It was their history of the church class. And they wanted me to come and talk about the future of denominations in this class, which I thought was odd, seeing as we're non-denominational. So I was going to speak into the future of denominations, and the teacher of the class said, "Don't worry about preparing anything, just come in, you'll interact with the kids, it'll be great." And what I realized is that I'm not very great at interacting with students. They just look so bored. It looked like death when I walked in there. And I'm trying to engage them, "Well, when we think about the future," and they were just not having any of it. And I'm like, "Oh, this is going awful." So I'm trying to sort of engage them somehow. I finally thought, well, maybe I can get them talking about their church experiences. And it was a class of about 30. I said, "How many of you go to church?" And of course, it's a Mennonite school, so a number of them do. So 14 of them put up their hands. And then I said, "How many of you would not go to church if your parents didn't make you?" And 13 hands went up. And I asked the one individual who would still go, and she's got a great youth group, and she loves it, so it's wonderful. And then I asked the rest what denomination they're from. It was Mennonite, Catholic, Presbyterian, and United seemed to be what made up the rest of the class. I said, "So tell me about why wouldn't you go to church if you didn't have to?" And the answers started pouring in. Suddenly, I got a lot of interaction. It started with, "Well, church is boring." So more specific, tell me. Tell me what you mean by that. They're like, "Well, sermons are boring. They're never relevant. They don't speak to me. The songs we sing are awful. Most of the time I have to stand around chatting with people I don't know, people who are older. Their lives are boring. They're old school." And then it was like, "It seems like we're doing nothing. We're just meeting to be bored and do nothing." And this went on for some time. In fact, there was too much engagement. The teacher said, "Whoa, okay, why don't we let Brad speak? We asked him to come in here this morning. Brad, why don't you tell the students why you think going to church is worthwhile?" And I answered the question this way. I said, "The exact things, students, that you're mentioning as boring and irrelevant are the very things that I have come to see that makes the potential of church powerful and dynamic. So where you see boring and irrelevant, I see an explosive potential." And I went on to explain why, though I don't think my efforts worked very well, but it really got me thinking. So this morning is a continuation of all we've been talking about the past few weeks, Jesus in disguise, the little way of being Christian. So this morning I want to push further that with a teaching I want to call the strength of weak ties. But it might be best called this: the world-changing power of conversations with people we don't know well and small acts of kindness. Let's start with Jean Vanier, founder of the L'Arche community, recently passed away, and his legacy is monumental. And one of the most profound words I have ever come across from Vanier goes like this. He said, "While we are alone, we could believe we loved everyone." And his point is that we can trick ourselves into believing we love the world, everyone. But when we love in a sort of abstract way, we imagine our hearts are big enough to be compassionate and kind to everyone. While we're alone, we can believe this. While we're alone with social media love and being able to sit behind our computers and sort of send out some sort of message, it's very easy to pretend we love the world, the whole entire world. But as Vanier likes to remind us, that's an illusion. We can't love everyone. And oftentimes what happens is we experience compassion, but what we know from psychology is that compassion is actually a stress reaction. And so observing the world, we see injustice or cruelty or suffering, and it stresses us out, right? And the stress results in compassion. But we're human and we're finite. And what we know from the world of psychology is that there is such a thing as compassion fatigue, because we can only handle so much stress in our lives. Thus, we can only handle so much compassion. And here's the thing. We live in a very hyper-connected world. We're exposed to tragedy after tragedy, cruelty after cruelty, problems, scandals, and our stress starts to mount. And we grow increasingly agitated. We're upset. We're distressed. And that eventually leads to us being exhausted and depleted, trying to carry the weight of the world on our shoulders. It's fatiguing. And so what we need to do, I think, is ground ourselves. It's impossible for one person, even one community, to carry the suffering of the entire world. It's impossible for any one of us to genuinely care about all the problems of the world. It's impossible to genuinely care about everything. There's just too many causes to support, too many hurting people. And so trying to carry that weight leaves us depressed. I think it leaves us cynical, leaves us full of despair. We're short-tempered, we're burnt out. Our arms just aren't big enough to hug the whole world. There's an environmental slogan I'm sure you've heard of. In fact, I think it's painted on the side of Borealis. Think globally, act locally, right? And I think the same approach could be applied to the Christian path. I think that essentially sums up the little way. Care globally, but love locally. And so what I'm thinking for many of us is we just need a new frame to help us carry kindness and compassion. We need like a more intimate scale of action to work with. And so what I've come to think is true is this: we love the world best when we love the piece of it right in front of us. We love the world best by loving the piece of it right in front of us. And if you can follow that, if you're in any way going, I think I agree, if there's any part of you resonating with that, we love the world best by loving the piece of it right in front of us, then I simply want to ask us three questions. First, when you think about your home, where you live, what is right in front of you? Second, when you head to work on Monday, or you head to wherever you spend the majority of your time during the week, what is right in front of you? And third, what is in front of you right now? Literally, right now. Okay, me. I need to feel the love, people. Please, please. All right, let's expand just right in front of you. What's around you right now, this moment? I think you ask those questions and you have suddenly an intimate scale of kindness and compassion to work with. Because it's hard to love abstractly. It could change when we have an intimate scale to work with. I like to think that I care about homelessness and that I care about things like mental health. But that could be very abstract. Sometimes I think we need to just focus on what's in front of us. Many of you know Gary. Gary Lawson. Hasn't been around here for a few weeks. Probably about 7 years ago, Gary walked into Nexus, and I'll be honest, he annoyed me. He was always asking for money, hard to carry a conversation with, but every Sunday morning he showed up. Every Sunday morning. Always the first one here. And over time, it became a bit of a nuisance for me. So I said, listen, if you're going to be here Sunday mornings, the least you can do is help me set up chairs, Gary. He said, that sounds like a job. You should pay me for that. Touche. Touche. So I said, listen, it takes us about 15 minutes to set up the chairs. We'll give you $10. Boom. That was great. Within a few months, he had snuck in a few extra special Sundays and somehow it bumped me up to $20 a week. Sunday morning after Sunday morning, Gary and me setting up chairs. And then it would lean into us going to play pool. And then I would go to his house. He has a room. We would play cribbage. I still think he's cheating me at cribbage. I'm not very good. But 52, 53, okay, I got 20. Your cards, okay, you got 3. I'm like, really? I don't know. But very good. But Gary hasn't been around for a while. He's been admitted to Freeport under long-term mental health care. And I tracked him down and visited him this week. And I sat with him, just listening to him talk. And those of you who have talked to him, you know that it's often hard for a conversation. He loves 1960s hockey, which I don't have a great frame of reference for. But and I remember sitting there thinking, what am I doing? I wish I could do something for Gary. Wish I could do something for him, but I found myself listening, sitting there with him, going, I don't know what to do here. And it's hard to carry a conversation. And it got me thinking, because the theologian Samuel Wells says the most important word in the Bible is with. And what Wells points out is that the story of Scripture is really about God being with us in different ways. God with us as individuals, as tribes, as people in exile, as communities. Scripture is the story of God being with us. More precisely, the story of God incarnated in Jesus is the pinnacle of God's desire to be fully and completely with us. In fact, Jesus is referred to as Emmanuel, which means God with us. And I think there's a cue here for us. What the Christian path coaches us to do is to be fully with those around us, fully with the people right in front of us. And so what I'm coming to learn, or trying to learn, especially with someone like Gary, is listen, I don't know what I can do about homelessness, mental health, but I can be with Gary. And I don't know if that's making much of a difference. But in terms of such a big, abstract idea and challenge of homelessness and mental health, I feel like that's the best I can do, is be with. And, you know, it brings me back to these high school students, and they're bored with church, and they feel like it's not as big and as meaningful as they want it to be. But it brings me back to this assertion that maybe the things we find hard and boring and seemingly irrelevant about church are the very things that give church its power. Because what it does is it gives us this intimate scale of people to work with. I think what church does is it puts very real people, very different people, right in front of us and says, listen, declaring how much you love all the right people and all the right causes, that's one thing, and good for you. We all see how righteous you are. But here's the real test. Can you simply love and be with these people right in front of you? Whatever it is, 80, 100, 150 of us, can you learn to be with them, love them, show kindness to them, be patient with them? Can you be with them? That's why I want to bring us to the conclusion of our season. We've got this Sunday and two Sundays left. I want to end in this vein. It's why I'm harping on Teresa's little way of being Christian, because what I so appreciate about the little way is the goal isn't to try to fix people. It's not about turning someone into a project. It's not about working or solving someone as an issue or problem. It's simply about expanding our territory of kindness so we can be with people. And I truly believe this is how we will change the world. Because here's the thing. I don't want to, for the rest of this morning, examine this from a theological perspective. I feel like I've already done that. I want to examine the idea of stretching ourselves to be with people from a sociological perspective. How does showing kindness, showing up to be with people, how does that change the world? I want to talk about social capital. But first, let's consider the early church. Consider a very curious fact about the early church. And I think this will surprise some of us, but it's hard to miss in my mind when you start really looking at it. The early church, following the example of Jesus, ignored the state. Jesus and his early followers were simply not political, at least not in the way we think political. And I'm not saying it's wrong for a person to be political or vote or anything like that, though I would say making a decision once every 4 years about who to elect is rather a small act. All I mean is this, trying to have the collective church influence the state, it wasn't on the radar of the early Christians. Their collective approach had nothing to do with trying to change the authorities and powers of the day, which is, I think, something we Christians of all stripes need to be reminded of. The way they enacted world-transforming change changed so massive that it ultimately became exploited by empire and has been ever since. But it started with people attracted to Jesus, attracted to the Christian path, forming communities where care was extended to everyone in need. We're told they sold their land, sold their possessions, sharing with each other. This is what Acts 2 has to say, and parts of Acts 4. All the believers devoted themselves to the apostles' teaching and to fellowship and to sharing in meals and to prayer. A deep sense of awe came over them all, and the apostles performed many miraculous signs and wonders. All the believers met together in one place, shared everything they had. They sold their property and possessions and shared the money with those in need. They worshiped together at the temple each day. They met in homes for the Lord's Supper and shared their meals with great joy and generosity, all the while praising God and enjoying the goodwill of all the people. All the believers were united in heart and mind, and they felt what they owned was not their own, so they shared everything they had. The apostles testified powerfully to the resurrection of the Lord Jesus, and God's great blessing was upon them all. There were no needy people among them. Now, this sounds like utopia. No. Sounds like a Marxist dream. Though we do have to remember, these actions were not government mandated, nor were they a state-run equity program. They weren't concerned with what the rest of the world was doing. They were described as a community of one heart, one mind. And so for these small communities, problems like hunger and homelessness, they were dealt with in the intimate space of local community. Small, local community. And for them, it was an outward expression of what it looked like to pray, God's will be done on earth as it is in heaven. This was how Jesus' presence was made real and manifest and enjoyed. Small, local communities attracted to Jesus and his path, living it locally. Now, I should caution. It drives me nuts when people glorify the early church. There can become this sense of nostalgia. If we could just get back to Acts 2. If we could just get back to Acts 2. I always like to say that. Read the rest of the New Testament and tell me if that's what you want, because things went south pretty quick. Utopia didn't last long. And so I don't like to allow myself to romanticize the past. The reality is these efforts by the early Christian communities, they often failed. And they struggled with the same kind of divisive issues that we have today. It was tough then, it's tough now. But it was successful enough, it took off. The question is how? How did it work? How did these small communities end up with no needy person among them? I thought I could try to convince us all to sell everything and move into a commune together. But three problems with that. First, I have my doubts about that. Second, Kristen would never let me say it. Third, I know where these things go. I'm going to end up being a cult leader, subject of an HBO miniseries, probably dead. It never works well. It doesn't work out well. I'm not interested, personally, in trying to recreate the conditions of 2,000 years ago. But I am interested in the sociological underpinnings. How does a small community end up having no needy people among them? I remember I was at a conference in South Carolina, and Mike Breen was the speaker, and it was sort of more of a small setting. There was about 50 of us church leaders there, and he was doing some stuff on the early church. And I remember he asked one day a question: why was the early church so successful? And I was like, oh, me. Like, it felt like Hermione Granger. I was like, I know the answer. And I was hand shot up, me. All right, what do you think? It is simple. The early church was successful because it resonated with the poor and marginalized. And I remember him being like, wrong. No. I said, what? He said, there's been countless movements in history that have resonated with the poor and marginalized. What set apart the early church was that it resonated with both the rich and the poor. It resonated with diverse groups of people. And when those diverse groups of people came together, it allowed for something called social capital exchange. What does that mean? What the early church did was practice a local politics of kindness, it managed somehow, centered around Jesus, to attract rich and poor, Jew and Gentile, men and women, slaves and their masters. And it convinced them to simply be with each other. With each other over meals, with each other over teaching, with each other over prayer. They were simply with each other, and that dynamic spread like wildfire. Because here's the thing, if you look at it microscopically, you think, sure, whatever, there's 100 people and there's no need among them, who cares? But these communities mushroomed. And very quickly, there were 1,000 churches with 100 people with no needy people among them. And voila, suddenly something's moving. But again, how? Mike Breen continued to explain these early churches communities were a hotbed of social capital exchange. It started in Acts 2 with everyone selling everything, but that didn't last long and was isolated to the Jerusalem church. What happened in the other hundreds of other churches, people simply agreed to be with each other over meals, over teaching, over prayer. And in that, a massive exchange of social capital occurred. How so? Social capital is simply this. It has to do with both the depth and the breadth of your social connections. When you have connections with many and diverse sorts of people, you have a lot of social capital. You're socially rich. You know a lot of people. You might even like connecting them. It's those people in life. You know who they are. They're saying, oh my goodness, you don't know Jim? Oh, I have to connect you with Jim. They love connecting people. These people are carrying a lot of social capital. They're rich socially. Now, by way of contrast, if you only have a few friends, a few acquaintances, and all of them are quite similar to you, you have very little social capital. You're socially poor. Now, why does any of this matter? Here's where things get interesting for me. In 1973, sociologist Mark Granovetter published a study called The Strength of Weak Ties. And in his terminology, a strong tie is a strong, intimate relationship you have. Someone very close to you, a trusted, intimate friend, maybe a partner, maybe a sibling. A weak tie, on the other hand, is an acquaintance, someone you know their first name, but beyond that, probably not so much. And in his study, he looked at how people found better jobs. Finding a job, getting a better job. Something, of course, that people perhaps in poverty would care a lot about. So his study focused strictly on how do people get jobs or better jobs. And what he found is that people found their jobs through weak tie relationships much more than strong tie relationships. When a person, he found, is looking for a new job, acquaintances are far more helpful than friends. Why? Our friends, of course, strong ties, they move in the same circles that we do. They're necessary. They give us a sense of belonging and trust and intimacy. But our intimate friends, they've got limited connections. We know most of the people our friends know. So they don't connect us with a wide variety of people. And so our friendships can be very deep, but they aren't very wide. What he discovered was knowing or having connections with a wide group of people is exactly the thing you need when you're looking for a job. This is the strength for him of the weak tie. Strong ties give us love and support. Weak ties give us width, many acquaintances. And this is the power of a rich social network. I would suggest it's the power of the church. In fact, Mike Breen argued the success of the early church was that it allowed people with poor social networks to suddenly gain an incredibly big amount of social capital. In the early church, very diverse groups of people sharing meals, sharing needs in prayer, and voila, magic starts to happen. If you were a woman, if you were a slave, if you were poor during the days of the early church, you probably knew very few people. But if we could have them be with people who had rich social networks, there we go. What would happen if that dynamic came to pass? Well, boom goes the dynamite. Everyone's social capital is raised. But this is the weird thing, is most of us don't even think or consider social capital. It's invisible to us. It's sort of one of these things that we swim in every day, so it's like a fish has no idea what water is. We can't see it. We take it for granted just because it's the norm. We don't even think of this stuff. So I want to illustrate to you from some examples of my own life, some other areas, how social capital works. I was looking through my kids' clothing drawer, and I realized I got 3 kids, 7, 5, and 3, and they're all growing, which is awful because it means they need new clothes a lot. What I realized by my math is that 95% of the clothes our kids have been handed down to us from people at Nexus, people in our neighborhood, family that lives close by. And here's the thing, Chris and I don't even consider that. It's normative that we would walk out onto our front porch and there's a garbage bag of clothes. Huh. In fact, a lot of times it's a pain. More clothes to wade through. We didn't even think about that. Now, contrast that with, say, a single mother. No post-secondary education. Working a minimum wage job. All of the people she knows are in the exact same position of her. The reality is this, garbage bags of clothes don't show up on her porch in the morning. Or children's health. Our children get sick a lot. Here's the thing. We know through connections to nurses, and we also happen to know Kristen's friend's husband is a pediatrician. I'll never forget the night. Huxley was sick with something, and you know, you're stressed out. What should we do? And of course, we called telehealth, which, I got to be honest, if we're looking for inefficiencies, because if anyone works for telehealth, I'm really sorry. But every time I've called telehealth, it always ends the same. You should probably go to emergency. Oh, thanks, eh? All right. We called. Kristen texted her friend. Hey, Hux is sick. We think we should go to emerge. What do you think? Within 5 minutes, we're Skyping a pediatrician. It wasn't like he gave Huxley a remedy, but said, you're okay not to go to emergency and to make a normal doctor's appointment tomorrow, the next day. Suddenly, we've saved the resources of the system, saved time and energy for ourselves. Well, consider some of us, you're working on your computer and it crashes. I gotta go to some Apple wizard and try to get that fixed up. Or you go, you know what? I know Bob and he knows computers. Maybe he might be able to tell me what's wrong with my computer. Or your car is making weird noises. And this just happened to me. Was making weird noises, and immediately, because I am ripe to be taken advantage of. Like, I was like, it's making weird noise, I'm going to take it in. If they say $1,500, $2,000, I'll be like, okay, I guess that's what it cost. I don't know. And then, he's not here this morning, there's a mechanic in the room here. And I simply said to him, my car's making weird noises. He said, why don't you come by and see me? So I did. $150 later, my car's fixed. That's the power of social capital. Or think about home improvements. You're like, I want to do something there. You happen to know an electrician, a plumber, a contractor. And it's not that they necessarily do something. You could say to them, hey, what do I do about this? They say, well, at least go to this guy. He'll give you an honest price, does good work, can help you navigate the system. Or just a few weeks ago, I put out on Facebook, hey, I need a new mattress because this one's killing my back. Like, people I haven't talked to in a decade. You really should go with this kind of mattress. Like, I've got so many recommendations, and so suddenly I'm not going to walk into Sleep Mattress knowing nothing. Now I've got an idea of how this works. Or just this week, our neighbor gave us a piano for free. But what I learned is people giving you pianos for free isn't free. And so the moment we got it moved into place, I hit the keys, and it was like, bang. I'm like, oh. What am I going to do? I got to get this tuned now. I don't know anything about tuning. I emailed John Benjamins. Hey, what should I do? He said, this is the guy to go to. Give you a fair price. Does great work. Well, just this week, I was having coffee with someone. And in the course of our conversation, he said, this is amazing. I have 2 job interviews, and they both came about via Nexus. I said, what? How? He said, Zoom Sunday. I got talking to people, and now I've got 2 job interviews. This is how the world turns. Many of our needs are met via social capital. And this is what happened with the early church. How it happened was simply people agreeing to be with very different people from them over meals, over teaching, over prayer. And from a theological perspective, I think you could say, well, there's much more going on than this. God is working powerfully. I don't doubt any of that. But that was the key ingredient sociologically. Small groups of people being willing to be with each other for teaching, meals, prayer. And all of a sudden, needs are being met. And here's the thing. Our appeals to our social support network are so normal, so natural, we don't even think about how vital they are in solving life's problems unless it's taken away from us. So imagine with me for a second, you have to move to Dallas, Texas. I don't know why, but it's an imagination exercise. You have to move to Dallas, Texas. So you pack up, you shed some tears, you say goodbye to everyone, you land there, you get unpacked in your house, and suddenly your car starts making funny noises. Your computer crashes. Your partner can't find a job anywhere. Your child is sick. You know no one. In terms of social capital, you're very poor. There's no one to answer questions, no one to point you in the right direction. You're 100% alone. Feels scary. Because here's the thing, we only notice social capital when it disappears and when we have none. And this to me brings us back to the power of being with people. I think the reality is that most people in life are actually very resourceful and capable. What we sometimes lack in life is not competency, but connection. If we just had the resources and connections, if we just had more social capital. But it's something we take for granted. But as Breen argues, the structure of the early church, what it simply did was this. It brought diverse groups of people together, which allowed for a rich social capital exchange. And that exchange transformed the world. And I would argue the little way of being Christian, loving locally, leaning into others, showing kindness and extending ourselves, simply committing to being with the people right in front of us, that, John Muir, is a powerful way to engage changing the world. And it happens one small community at a time. And what it does is it relieves us of the stress and anxiety of thinking illusionally that we have to somehow change the whole world. What we have the power to do is simply lean in with kindness, with what is right in front of us. And on the surface, I think this probably feels like a fairly weak approach, but when you realize the strength of weak ties, I think it could become the exact intervention we need in a world where there are very real needs, in a world that is increasingly lonely, anxious, desperate to make some kind of change, do something meaningful. Social capital is something we shouldn't ignore. It's the strength of the weak tie. And so consider, what are we doing when we go to Warren and Jenny's on June 21st? There's two different ways to approach it. One is we're simply going to have a good time, which we shall. But there's also the very real notion that what we're doing is exchanging social capital. Every conversation I have is building social capital. Boomerang groups. When you join a boomerang group, if you consider that for this fall, what are you doing there? Yes, we're growing spiritually, we're discussing things, but you're also widening your affections, widening your social capital. This summer, we have a number of Sundays where it might look like we're doing nothing. We're off those Sundays, but we're choosing to call those Sundays this summer small church Sundays. And so there's the Benjamin's pool party coming up. There's Todd's history walk. In between, there are Sundays that are off, but they're not off. It just depends on how you choose to approach them. We want to call them small church Sundays because what we would like to encourage you to do, and if you're away at the cottage or wherever, that's fine, do your thing. But if you're home here, why not invite someone you know, someone you don't really know? You go, wow, but that would be awkward. Ah, but it's widening our social capital. When you join a creative team here at Nexus, band, ushers, preaching guild. Even when you serve with Nexus Kids, what you're doing is more than just serving a need. You're also agreeing to be with people. Sundays, when you stop and you notice that person who isn't talking to anyone and they seem like a stranger to you and it feels like, I'm just going to ignore that. Or you can press in and say, I'm going to say hello. I'm going to maybe start a conversation. Why? Not just because you have to, but because what we are doing is widening, expanding our social capital. One of the biggest reasons we started Soup Sundays this year at Nexus was exactly this. We need more people talking over food. And I think it's one of the greatest things we've done in 9 years at Nexus. I think it's a wonderful thing. I hope we can lean into it more next year. But when we stop and have soup and say hi to a stranger, what we're doing is not just eating soup. We're instituting this social revolution of broadening our social ties. Because here's the thing. We as a community of people, we are attracted to Jesus. And a couple of weeks ago, Katie Taylor did a sermon. And it was wonderful. I just got a chance to listen to it this week. One of the questions she asked is, how do we navigate between tribes and tribalism? And it's interesting. One of the things I would say is this. Tribes, in the healthiest sense of the word, are attracted to something. They want to follow something they all love. Tribalism is when you gather because you hate something. And we see a lot of that. We have a common enemy. But that's not us here at Nexus. We gather together because we love the Christian path, or at the very least are curious about it. I want to make sure everyone feels included. You don't have to sign any membership documents here. But even if you're just vaguely curious, this is interesting, I'm willing to explore. Yes, that's what we're doing. We're committed to that and allowing God's Spirit to help us grow into the kinds of people God created us to be. That's why we gather. The magic of it all is not in a sermon or a song or a wine night per se. Though, I should add, I still held out hope that those can be magical on their own. But the real magic is centering ourselves around Christ, watching a diverse group of people be with each other. And as that happens, needs are met. Social capital increases. Lives are changed. The only question that remains for me is this: will you be with us? Leadership team, myself, we've been thinking a lot, doing a lot of work, thinking about next year. And it's become least clear to me in certain ways. For the early church, the key to the early church was loving locally by simply being willing to be with each other for teaching, meals, and prayer. I've been thinking about this. Teaching, we already do that. Let's hope we don't have to change too much about that. No. Maybe. That, okay, we got that piece. But loving locally, that could be organic, but I think we could also use some work on a person or some people helping us see what is right in front of us. Because sometimes it's not always intuitively obvious what's right in front of us and how we could be with those around us. So perhaps we need more attention on loving locally and empowering some people to help us see what is in front of us. Meals. Soup Sunday is a great start, but I think we can ratchet that up because, as Warren said, the magic that happens when you bring people together over food with wine, it's greater than the sum of its parts. Something happens there. People talk, people share, you get to gain social capital. But then I was sort of stuck on prayer. What does that mean? And it hit me this week. They were with each other for prayer. And I thought about it because I'm like, I know there's a lot of people skeptical about prayer here and what it does. And then it hit me. What is the magic about prayer? In prayer, people share needs. And so, if we're going to sort of lean into the social capital mix, there's got to be ways for people to share needs. I have a friend who they do a simple practice in their church called Prayer of the People. Write down your prayers, stick them in a box, and somebody comes to the front, just prays them off. It can be as mundane as somebody, I was talking to him, he said somebody recently put in pray for the Raptors, so they prayed for the Raptors. It could be I need a job. It could be anything. But there's got to be a way for a community to hear needs, and prayer is the perfect expression the way people express needs. Meals are the way that we gain social capital and figure out what sort of resources people have. There's a synergy there, and teaching is what often draws us together so that we can have meals, have prayer. And so for me, I'm hoping season 10, will you be with us? Because we want to lean heavier into meals, heavier into prayer, and hope that by doing that, we'll create an environment where we take what we have here and move it just a little bit forward. And I'm not promising any grand scale victories, but it might be small, like someone getting a job interview, or somebody fixing your car when you thought it would cost you $1,500, or somebody agreeing to tutor your child. Whatever it is, these small things can do a lot so that there are no needy people among us. That's what I got for this morning. So, I'm going to ask the band to come and close. But I want to leave that lingering question with you, because we don't talk about commitment and, you know, kind of, hey. But will you be with us? Summer's a great way to recharge. Give ourselves permission to just be off. Enjoy the rhythm of summer. Enjoy the nice weather. But use those small Sunday churches to maybe get to know some people. And will you come back here in the fall, ready to be with us? Two more Sundays, so there's still that to come. But in the meantime, I hope that you will consider that and how the early church changed the world and what we might do to follow that. Dave?